Today's episode of the Theater People podcast is brought to you by Stage Door Manor. For information on their summer theater programs, check them out at stagedoormanor.com. Welcome to the Theater People podcast. I'm your host, Patrick Hines. You guys, the 2017 Tony Awards are less than a week away. I can barely breathe. So today we're bringing you two of my favorite nominees from this year. Up first, Bandstand's Andy Blankenbuehler. Andy is, of course, the show's director and choreographer, and he's nominated for his choreography. Andy's been working on Broadway as a performer, director, and choreographer since 1992. He won his first Tony Award in 2008 for choreographing In the Heights, and he won another last year for choreographing Hamilton. Because we could have talked to him about everything and we didn't have hours for that, we're focusing today just on his work with Bandstand. But don't worry, he'll be back. Here's our conversation. First of all, hi, Andy Blankenbuehler.
Hey, how's it going?
I mean, this is like a dream interview for me.
Oh, please. It's great to be in this community. And like, you just asked me how crazy the award season is. You know, it's not crazy because I just love seeing people and love sharing the theater.
Totally. I mean, like everybody, Hamilton, you know, In the Heights are such like meaningful, like theatrical things for me. So over the years, I've gotten to meet almost all of you now involved in the creative team. And it's like, I do this for a living, but it's also like I can't hide my inner fan. So if I start squealing like a girl, just bear with me, please.
I know what it's like. I just love it, too.
So Bandstand, first of all, congratulations. I just saw it the other night. I'm bringing my husband back next week because I'm obsessed with it.
It's a beautiful show. I mean, it's so emotional. It triggers so many deeply American things, parental things. I mean, it triggers so many things. And I'm just proud to be on this journey. It was a long journey, and I'm proud of how we've gotten here.
I wasn't going to start here, but I'm realizing, I think one of the things I connected to so strongly about it was the military aspect. Both my sister and my husband's brother are in the military and have served several tours in Iraq and Afghanistan and now in Africa. I'm curious about, this is the one thing I don't know about your background. Do you have any sort of military background, or how did you find the like authenticity in that part of the story?
You know, like Bring It On, like In the Heights, these are things I learned. My grandfather did serve. My uncle served. My father-in-law served in World War II. So it has been part of my history, but like the subject matter of the story, no one talked about it. My father-in-law, who's very Italian from Brooklyn, actually talked about it all the time. Like, he loved it. He loved his friends. It was very social. He wasn't on the front. And so for him, it was like how he cut his teeth. He became a man in the war. My more American side of the family, my father's side of the family, like, I never heard stories about my grandfather serving, which is very much what Bandstand is about. It's about, like, I went through this very hard thing, and I'm going to keep my chin down in an American way and move forward. And so I didn't have a lot of experience with it, and I never liked history. You know, people didn't know that about me with Hamilton either. Like, I never read the Hamilton book. I never liked history class. But now that I'm a man and I have kids, like, now history is really important because history is who I am now. It's who my kids are. It's who we want to become. So it's more of a living lesson than like a past lesson. But one thing that I was always passionate about was the 1940s. I love swing music. I love jazz music. I love like American dance and American music through like the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And so I dug that totally. I dug the fashions totally. And, you know, I have such an appreciation for like the sort of when you see like photos of the era or paintings of the era, Norman Rockwell, like that just rings true to me in some way that feels almost like a graphic novel. Like, it feels like it's a picture of time. And so when I took on this piece, I wanted to sort of do that. I wanted to capture it. So like that picture of time felt vibrant again, felt current, not unlike sort of how we do like Right Hand Man in Hamilton, like let George Washington step out of the oil painting and communicate with you in a way you're not used to.
It's funny that you say that because, you know, Laura Osnes has been a friend of our podcast, and she's so, I mean, stunning is just the only human word I can think of to describe her. But, you know, so much of your artwork for the show, I think I wouldn't have thought about the Norman Rockwell thing until you said it, but it does have that sort of, she's just so perfect for it. One of the stories that she has told on this podcast was how she was sort of like famously unavailable for your lab, and how you guys sort of like shifted things around to make it so that she could be there and be a part of it. Why was Laura so essential to the creation of the show?
You know what? Laura is just, Laura has every chop in the world. Like, she can sing, she can act, she's a wonderful person, she can dance, she can do everything. And so there is a quality of like in the business, you want to work with people who you know are good. But the other thing is, there's a class classic nature of the show, and there's an ambiguous, let's make a contemporary nature of the show. And no one feels more classic than Laura to me. Like, it seems like you could put her in a time and place and chisel her out of stone, and you'll always have her there in that sort of vibrant, three-dimensional sculptural way. And I love that. And I think that's rare for personalities on stage to have that thing, like Julie Andrews had it. Like, you see these performances where the people just are exploding in their own skin. But she just feels like the era. And I also knew it was an opportunity for her to stretch herself a little bit and to be a little gutsy and to be a little ugly at times in terms of screaming out the truth. So it just felt right. And I'm of the mindset, I'm a family guy, and I have a lot of people close to me. I feel like when you develop a rapport with somebody, you should stay there. And I'm always willing to bend schedules to make it work for people. I remember being a performer and being unavailable by a couple days for a project, and they never looked back. Or I remember being down to a final callback for something that felt really right to me, and I couldn't attend the final callback, so my chances were over. I'm not like that as a director. Like, if somebody can't make the final callback, I'm going to have a private session with them. Like, I'm going to, if I believe in them, I don't care about rules, I don't care about schedules, like, I'm going to make it work.
Yeah. Your connection to this piece is like 30-ish years in the making. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I grew up in Cincinnati. Starting in first grade, my best friend was a guy named David Kreppel. And so we went all through grade school, all through high school together. We did musicals together. We were in The Sound of Music, all these shows. And then in high school, we started doing high school theater at St. Xavier High School, which has put out so many Broadway pros. Like, next door to Sharon Wheatley and Come From Away is from there.
No way.
Down the street, Anne Yee, who choreographed Sunday in the Park, she's from there.
Wow.
Up at Cats, The Standby for Grisabella, Jess Hendy, she's from there. We're all from the same school.
Like a public high school?
Like a private Catholic school with no arts program.
That is crazy. What's in the water there?
I know.
And you have to bottle it and send it.
Amazing director named Michelle Mascry. And we all loved what we were doing. And so David and I started doing shows there in high school. After my sophomore year, we did Godspell, which changed my life. Thank you, Stephen Schwartz. David and I went to a high school theater camp called Summer Music Institute at CCM. And we met Richard Oberacker, who wrote Bandstand. He went to another high school in Cincinnati. And David and Richard ended up being roommates at CCM, where they studied musical theater. I moved straight to New York. And then our lives crashed back together all these years later. David did the vocal arrangements, and Richard, wrote the music and co-lyrics with Rob. And so it was a nice coming home. It was also a reminder that when you meet people early on in a sort of cataclysmic event of saying, like, when your passions collide into each other, you're always going to be like-minded in some way, and your paths are going to come back in touch with each other. And even if we didn't, like, Richard and I weren't really friends, but we shared something that was so real that when we came back around again, it's just like we never had sort of distanced ourselves from each other. So it was really nice, actually.
And those theater schools are really, really important. Andrea Burns has a really interesting story with Jason Robert Brown about meeting at Stage Door Manor, I think. And, like, I'm not an actor, but I got to go to one of those theater programs. And it's, like, the opportunity to get to, like, meet other like-minded kids in a setting like that in the summer is just, like, invaluable.
It's also not unlike Hamilton and unlike In the Heights, where people are coming to the theater from anew, and people are saying, oh, I see myself on the stage. Like, and all of a sudden, like, these kids or young audiences are seeing themselves in George Washington, but from the oil paintings with white hair, I never could do that.
Yeah.
And so all of a sudden, to see a portrayal on stage that makes you feel at home, it helps you with healing, it helps you with closure, it helps you with inspiration, it helps you move forward. And I think when people meet, like at theater camps and stuff like that, because they're at their most base vulnerability in terms of like spending time on their passion, it's just like a magnet between people.
Yeah. Can we talk a little bit about, and this is certainly not your first go at this, but, like, just the mania of, like, taking on a brand new musical from scratch. What made you in this case want to take that on again, knowing what you were getting yourself into?
You know, it's an unreal difficult thing. And I remember about a month and a half ago, I had just finished, like, the third version of the opening number, and this is our second opening number. And I went home and I was totally depressed at the end of the evening. And my wife, and I said, this one's harder than ever. And she said, no, it's not. That's what you say every time. Like, every time you finish the opening number, you say it's horrible, and why are opening numbers so hard? She said it's like childbirth. It's the most beautiful thing. It's so painful, but since it's so beautiful, you forgot how painful it was. Mm-hmm.
Thank God for spouses.
Thank God for spouses. She's like my, she equalizes me on everything. But making a new musical is really, really hard. Especially, you know, it's helpful when you have an umbrella of a realistic issue. Like World War II happened. Those details happened. Those people happened. That clothing happened. Those locations happened. The music happened. And so even though you're making everything brand new, a brand new character, a brand new location, a brand new song, it's still within an umbrella that you understand. I felt the same way in a Bring It On world. If I were to write a musical about a creature underwater on Mars, how do you start that? Unless you decide, he's shy. Then you can start, or whatever it is. So with Bandstand, it is really difficult to make a brand new musical, but you rely on the textures you know. So when two characters speak to each other, you know what? Two men would never speak like that in the 40s. And so there's your rule. And so there's a lot of trial and error for years for the writing team and for the director about finding what the rules are. How would a character act? How would a character dress? What do we need a wall there to tell us there's a wall there? You learn things quickly as you're making a piece. Some shows have to fail a lot. Some shows don't. Like Hamilton didn't have to fail a lot because Lin saw it so specifically in his head and he hit the book as a real framework. But a new musical is really difficult because you also can't predict what the audience's expectation of it is going to be. You have to use your best creative instinct and you have to jump in. You know, so when you're working on a new piece, it does help to be around a veteran team because they've been through the fire. And they're going to, like, I catch myself saying all the time, the audience isn't going to laugh there. Well, how do you know that audience isn't going to laugh there? Your instinct has to tell you that. Or when I'm working on a piece of choreography, I know if I'm confusing the audience or if I know, like, I'm making them lean forward. Like, I can tell those things. Not every time, of course. I'm like, not God. But you learn through.
Some listeners would disagree with that heartedly.
You learn through experience. You know, I fail all the time. There's a Bring It On story I'll tell you later that is an epic lesson to me about failing. And they're hard. And I tell you, this show went well, and I got a Tony nomination, and audiences are loving it. But when I walk away from it, nothing is done, and nothing is perfect. And so I'll go home and try to detox for the days and weeks that follow an opening, and I feel like I've gone through a breakup, or I feel like I've gone through a death, and it's a hard time. And luckily, like, this time of year is perfect, because it's spring, and I haven't seen my kids, and it's sunny, and so I can actually bounce back into real life. If we open the show in February, I probably have jumped off the bridge by now.
You guys went to Paper Mill before coming here, and I believe that Paper Mill is where Corey Cott joined your team, is that right?
Yeah.
I was just going to ask, how did you find him? Why? Oh, and while I'm thinking of it, I wanted to give a shout out because I saw his understudy, and I, of course, can't think of his name. Jonathan Shue. I love an understudy, and I'm sad I didn't get to see Corey. It's one of the reasons I'm coming back. But how did you find Corey, and why was he the right fit?
You know, it's interesting. We started developing the piece with Jeremy Jordan, and I love Jeremy. I've done a couple things with him. Laura has a great rapport with him, and Jeremy really liked the piece, and we did several readings together, and he had a great energy. And ultimately, he got his TV show, and he became unavailable, and he really wanted to work on TV and film. And of course, there was, like, literally, I saw Corey Cott's picture replace his picture in Newsies, and I never saw Corey, but everyone on the street kept talking about Corey, about Newsies, but also just in general. And I was like, who's this Corey Cott kid? And then he did Gigi, and ironically, our casting agent cast Gigi, and so there's, like, a don't touch policy, because if somebody's unavailable, you don't poach from each other. And so I never could audition him for the show. And then our schedule shifted, that schedule shifted, and all of a sudden he was available. And so I brought him in and I met with him. We sang a couple songs. We just spent like a half an hour. It was an audition, but it wasn't an audition because, like, I knew he was great. And so basically it was just about figuring out, did he have walls up? Is he going to be game to jump in on anything? And Corey is game to jump in on anything. And he uses his brain constantly. And so I was instantly taken by him. I was instantly taken by his amazing energy and ability to try 1,000 things back to back to back. And so he got me right from the get-go.
I was thinking when you were talking about the show opening and how you didn't feel it's done. One of the composers I interviewed last year for Broadway Backstory said a show never finished. It just opens. And I was wondering what your thoughts on, like, the difference between the Paper Mill production and this production, and just sort of, like, letting it go once it opens.
The course of this show's development was unlike any other that I did, in that it changed composition completely.
What does that mean?
We started the show, and I knew I liked the ideas in the show, but when we did the first reading, it was almost like a play with music, and it felt like an older generation's piece. It didn't feel like it was making me lean forward. It didn't feel like a piece a 25-year-old would enjoy. But I like the ideas. So we kept working on it. We streamlined it. Second reading, it improved in terms of energy. When we did the show at Paper Mill, and authors were in agreement, but I was like, it needs to be robust. It needs to be fluid, and it needs to be have a robust passion about it, that there's a wall up that's not letting the passion out, as opposed to waiting for something to happen. There had to be impediments in front of it. And so the writers did amazing work. But the show at Paper Mill felt like my parents' musical a little bit. It felt like actually the musical that Rich, Robert, and I, you know, wanted to honor through the Golden Age musical. We loved those musicals. And so we wanted to flirt with that world, but not duplicate that. Because I think the audience now wants something that's more than that. It's very hard in those old school musicals to suspend your disbelief the way the audience now demands. Yeah. And so the show there was entertaining, but it felt like a 1950s musical. It moved very linearly. There was too many set changes. There were too many locations. It was too literal from my point of view, from my work. It felt like traditional scenes and then traditional songs. And my biggest complaint for myself was that there wasn't a point of view for the ensemble that would let the staging be stylized all night long. Mm-hmm. If the ensemble doesn't have a building block of a foundation to jump off of, you can't use them to help change the scenes, to help create physical architecture through body language.
Can I ask you about that? Do you mean that the audience has to be informed of how the ensemble is going to be used?
No. If they don't have a definition and they're changing people just constantly, like to me, like Gypsy is an amazing musical, but I'm not interested in choreographing Gypsy, because in Gypsy, like this character is going to play a stage manager that moment and he's going to play a Corinne that moment, like whatever it is. Like I want the ensemble to all have the basic same need. And Gypsy does. I don't want to discredit Gypsy, but a similar need to the principal actors in a way that they can be the impressionistic painting around the actor so they can always be there. Perfect example in Bandstand. There's a moment where they're walking down the street and Donnie's really freaking out and he's like, I'm letting my best friend down, and that best friend is haunting, the memory is haunting him from the war. So all of a sudden people walking down the street can go into war vocabulary around him because that's actually what's in Donnie's head. And last year at Paper Mill, the show didn't give that permission. And so we did that in many ways. We rewrote the opening number and got away from traditional music and made it a more aggressive sound that let us be more stylized. We took scenes and overlapped them with each other. We started doing more aggressive fluid ideas that I like to do. And that allowed you to not question weird things that actors were doing, or I can move chairs and all of a sudden be in a VA office in a way that I'm not watching the scene shift happen. It feels organic for the characters. And so that changed greatly between Paper Mill and now. And many people were like, oh, after Paper Mill, were like, oh, that was a nice show and that was a nice exercise, but it's going to be done there. And we knew it wasn't going to be done there because we knew the potential. And like you said before, somebody says stop. Somebody says you have to be done. You have to open the show for right now. So at Paper Mill, we got to where we were and we walked away knowing what we were going to do next. And luckily, we got the chance to do it next.
How was it for you to get to now see, like, watch the show, like this thing that you started from nothing, and get to see it in all of its glory on Broadway?
You know, I'm tremendously proud of the show, mostly because I feel my work as a director is the best it's been, and it's very cohesive with my work as a choreographer. So it feels like a singular vision, which was the reason Richard and Rob came to me. They wanted a show with a singular vision that way. I'm also proud of the problem solving we did, because as director, you have to lead that. You have to lead the writers to ask hard questions and the actors to ask hard questions. I'm also proud because more than any show I've done to date, all design elements are on the same page. I have a great relationship with David Correns and Jeff Kreuter, and all of our work together feels very sculptural and feels very beautiful, and at the same time, very character-driven. Mm-hmm. So, you know, ultimately, I see it on the stage now, and I mean, I cannot believe that I have three shows running on Broadway. And but I can't believe I have one show on Broadway. Like, I'm just a kid who loves to do what they do, but it really means a lot to me. I'm almost outside myself to see the show and say, I don't know how that happened, but I'm really proud of that.
And now, a few words from our sponsors. Do you wake up humming Hamilton and singing Sondheim? Do you dream of a place where there are Shakespeare flash mobs, Happy Birthday is sung in harmony, and surprise Broadway guests fill your world? At Stage Door Manor, kids from every state and six continents spend their summer totally immersed in the magic of theater. I'm sure almost all of you know that Stage Door Manor is the inspiration for Todd Graff's movie Camp and Mickey Rapkin's book Theater Geek. But did you know that you've seen plenty of their alums on stage, screen, and behind the scenes? Natalie Portman, Mandy Moore, Zach Braff, Robert Downey Jr., Sean Levy, and Janine Tesori all spent their summers in the Catskill Mountains of New York. Stage Door Manor produces an unbelievable 42 full-scale shows in 8 on-campus theaters, and there are more than 100 classes at beginning and advanced levels, everything from playwriting to stage combat. If it's theater-related, they do it. Stage Door premieres include original stage versions of Rent, Avenue Q, Andrew Lippa's Wild Party, Woman in White, and High School Musical. Stage Door welcomes kids ages 10 to 18, and there are no auditions for admission. They accept all levels of experience and talent and find roles for students in shows where everyone can have his or her moment in the spotlight. Worth Magazine named Stage Door among the top 10 summer programs in the world, and it's been called the Hollywood High of Summer Camps by Playbill. No wonder sessions fill up quickly. Spots are almost gone for the summer, so hurry and go online to StageDoorManor.com for more info. You guys, for our second segment, I'm thrilled to welcome Johanna Day, who's currently starring in and is Tony nominated for her work in Sweat, which is running at Studio 54. Sweat, which won this year's Pulitzer Prize for Drama, tells the story of a group of friends who've spent their lives sharing drinks, secrets, and laughs while working together on the factory floor. But when layoffs and picket lines begin to chip away at their trust, the friends find themselves pitted against each other in a heart-wrenching fight to stay afloat. It really is one of the most powerful shows I've seen this season, and I was so excited to get to chat with Johanna about her work in it. Here's our conversation. Hi, Johanna Day.
Hello, Patrick.
It is so nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
It's so exciting because we, like, never get to talk to, like, to play actors. We're always talking to musical actors.
I know. They get all the attention.
But that means I have so many questions because I don't know how, what's a play exactly?
You saw it. There's not a lot of singing and dancing.
It's weird. I was like, but the music comes in the second act,
I guess. Well, that second scene with the ladies' entrance, you know, we were dancing.
That's true. See, yeah. It's basically a musical.
Yeah. It's a little, yeah.
Congratulations on Sweat.
Thank you so much.
Holy moly. What a play.
Oh,
it is. I was thinking about this today. Like, I had a very strong reaction to it, as I'm assuming a lot of people do.
They do, yeah.
It's weird, and maybe this sounds like a crazy thing to say, but it's a weird thing to see a play about your country in a time in which, essentially about a time in which it's about a very, like, the play is very focused on a thing, you know, that is very real about our country.
Right.
And it was, that doesn't happen a lot.
No, and as I said before, well, you know, Lynn started, Lynn Nottage wrote it.
Most people are like, Lin-Manuel Miranda wrote this?
You and your musicals.
Exactly.
Lynn Nottage. This is her second Pulitzer Prize.
Oh my God, I know.
And she started researching it in 2011, right? So, you know, right. Who wasn't in the picture.
Exactly.
And the play itself takes place in 2000 and 2008.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, mostly in 2000. So, yep. I mean, fortunately and unfortunately, it is the most relevant piece play right now.
And how could she have known? You know what
I
mean?
No.
Other than to say that, like, mining and, like, factory towns are very much a thing that, like, our country has to deal. We have to figure out.
Well, it's been going on for, people have been waving their arms in the air for a long time for help. And everyone's promised them. And it, you know,
I have to say that, like, you know, it was enraged. Like, as a person who's lived in New York City for 17 years and Boston before that, I'm from cities. And so it rarely occurs to me that in our country there are entire towns whose way of life, whose entire economy is based on one company's factory being there.
You know, really up until just a little while ago, I mean, that's really the majority of our country.
Right, of course.
The working class, mm-hmm. you know, that build everything we need.
Yeah.
You know? And I mean, it was shocking to me. You know, I'm this liberal hippie artist type. Like, I'm up for everybody. I love it. But I learned so much about my ignorance.
Right. I want to talk about that. So
about my ignorance.
I'd really like to delve deep into your ignorance, if you don't mind. Okay. First of all, this play premiered off Broadway at the Public Theater like a year ago. Is that right?
Mm.
Longer.
No. We finished December 18th last year.
Okay. How did you get the job in the first place?
Well, it's an interesting story. I did it. I worked with Kate Wariski, the director,
yep,
several times. And I was going to do another. We did it down. You know, Oregon Shakes originated it.
Right.
It originated up there. And then most of the cast came down to D.C. and I joined them. And with like 9 days rehearsal, and it was a big decision to make because I was going to do another play, and but I read it and it scared me to death. Mm-hmm. So I figured,
yeah,
and the part too. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, we got to talk about Tracy. I have a lot of questions about Tracy.
And so I did it down there, and then they were bringing it to New York, and I wasn't sure if I was going to do it or not, and then. It turns out I was at the Public, so that's what happened. It was offered to me in the first place because Kate's worked with me so much.
Yeah.
And then we were three, you know, the rumors were that it was going to Broadway, you know, and then it did, and we were just thrilled to death.
Yeah.
And the transfer was really amazing too, because I thought, oh no, all our rehearsal there on Broadway is going to be just staging and reconfiguring, but John Lee Beatty, the designer, and Kate and everybody, it just was wonderful because we got to just chisel away at the scenes and just get deeper. That's how Kate works, deeper and deeper into these really three-dimensional people, which is what Lynn wanted, because you don't want them to be representatives of a type of person. You know what I mean?
Yep.
You need to really kind of care about them, and you can care about, I think, every single person in this play.
For sure.
You know?
I mean, I think that the thing about this play is that you have very there are moments that you really love and identify with each character, and there are moments that you just hate each character.
And you're mad at them.
Yeah, exactly.
You're like, I liked you.
Exactly.
What
exactly.
are you doing?
And I think that Tracy is such an unbelievably complicated character. Mm-hmm. And I think, I'm just a crazy person now that I'm a parent, because I approach everything from, like, having... I was not a parent... not very long ago.
Uh-huh.
So, like, I can remember...
Oh, your life's, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. I want to just tell the audience that before we get, like, we dive into Tracy, Lynn Nottage, who, like, the brilliant Lynn Nottage, who, this is her second Pulitzer, like you said, the first one was for Ruined,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
She began researching this in 2011 when the Census Bureau singled out Reading, Pennsylvania as the poorest town in America.
Of its size, yeah.
Of its size. And she just wanted to go, I feel like, and just, like, sort of investigate the town.
Yeah, it started, I mean, she tells, it's a really long, the beginning, the genesis of it is a little farther, you know, what happened, a friend had emailed her, she found out her friend was really, really broke and she was a single mother. But anyway, so she started getting, and Occupy Wall Street was going on,
yeah,
at the time, and she just started getting interested in the new poor, you know, the disenfranchised.
Yes.
And then she researched at the time that Reading was the poorest city, and I mean, it is a hub of business. I mean, the railroad. It's,
yeah,
like, it's a,
right.
It's got its place on the monopoly board.
Right.
And
right, of course.
Yeah. And so, you know, and then it's all gone. I mean, we did a talk back last night, and it seems like, I think it was a big wake up call. And I think they're really trying to take care of each other and build their city back up again. And
yeah.
Humanity.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about your character, Tracy.
Okay.
And I have a lot of... The questions I have are really more for Johanna.
Johanna.
Is it Johanna?
Yeah. Oh,
I'm such a dummy. Johanna.
No, everybody does it. And
God.
I'm just... Please don't worry about it. Joe. You can call me Joe.
Are we best friends now?
Yeah, we're totally best friends.
I want to know how, as an actor... What your process is. I'm not an actor, so I don't really understand how it all works. Do you? My major question is, if there are things about your character that you don't like, that are bad, are
like decisions she makes,
decisions
and like how
she makes, and
how to get there, right?
Yep. How do you? Do you? Are you able to approach a character without judging her? Can you play a character without having opinions about her, or do you need to have that? Or what's the deal there? Because
I think
Tracy's very
it,
complicated.
Yeah. If you read, the part, you read the play, and you're like, that's what I meant when I read it. I was like, this play is amazing, but how do I do that? Because so much of what she is, I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
But there's many things she is that I am and that I would like to be.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of the fierce loyalty. She's much tougher. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Tougher than
yes.
I am.
Yes.
You know, hard worker. I'm a pretty hard worker. She loves to laugh. I have that. She's funny. She's irreverent. You
yeah.
know, I'm kind of irreverent. But when you first read it, you're like, oh, okay, that's I was going to cuss. Okay.
You get. Oh, you may. Please.
This is. This play is just. I already have a terrible mouth, and now every other word is a cuss word out of my mouth. Seriously, it's bad.
Yeah.
Like, just in front of people I shouldn't be doing it for. Right. But so you see that they're shitty, making some really stupid decisions. The one thing that really helped with this, because of the way it's written and the way Kate directed us, like say she just, say Michelle Wilson and I, who play best friends.
Yeah, Cynthia, she's so great in it
too.
Isn't
she amazing?
Yeah.
Every single person in this
Everyone
cast
is amazing. So many Broadway debuts too.
Brilliant. Yeah, tons. And when we're having our arguments, and oh, that's another thing is we took every opportunity we could to really show how close of friends they were so that you could more heartbroken when things go awry. But, Kay would turn to me and be like, listen, this is your argument. And we'll talk about, I don't want to tell too much about the end of the play, but that's pretty much the only time that, I know why she does that. And she pays for it when you see that in 2008.
Yes.
That woman would not be in that state if that situation had not happened. She would have gotten a job. She would have been fine.
Yeah.
But everything else, though, she was one of like many, many people. Like, I'm not a racist. I'm cool with everyone, but pops up, But as far as her argument to her best friend about you're not walking with us. You're not, we've done this since 18 years old. And that's what Lynn has done also is that everybody in this play is complicit in a way. Like for Tracy, it's, she's standing strong with the union and she's saying, this is what happened. This is the union's not standing up for me. Do you know, do you know what this is like? She's had that scene when she's, it's Michelle's character's birthday party. It's not a party at all.
her birthday gathering.
I just come in to ruin everybody's parties. I get the good one and then it just goes downhill from there. I ruin Jesse's. Kay would turn to you and be like, this is really the truth.
Yeah.
You have a point here.
Yeah.
And then she turned to Michelle and reiterate Michelle's point for Cynthia. Like, this is really what you're going through. It's all very real and justified.
Yeah.
So that's where you go. It's like me, I'd probably be like, well, come on, wouldn't you? I'd be wimpier about it, but she's not.
Yeah. Tracy is like like a bulldog. Like she's like,
she's not a bully.
No, she's not. She's not. And she's fierce. When you when you're the audience and you are zoomed out just by virtue of knowing that you're sitting in a theater and knowing that you're watching a play, there's something about seeing the way these people are pitted against each other when nobody in that room is the bad guy. Like the bad guy are the other people who are causing this turmoil amongst the friends.
And unfortunately what happens instead of going, who's the bad guy here?
Right.
Because you're going to turn to the people right next to you.
Exactly.
And that's where they just break apart.
I want to ask you, and we won't give too much detail about it, but we know that there's something has happened that has caused these boys to go to jail.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we know they're in jail. We don't really know what they're in jail for. We find out in the second to last scene in the play or at the very end of the play, we see the whole thing play out.
Yeah.
And it is bone chillingly riveting to watch. And Tracy in that scene doesn't let up. And there's something about, I don't know, this is kind of a technical question about the stamina and what it takes to have your most emotional moment at the very end of a play. Because I was watching, and I can't think of his name now, of course, the young man who plays your son.
Oh gosh, Will Pullen.
It's
a complicated scene. He has to really.
It could all fall apart
really
if he doesn't
hard
get nail
job.
It. Yeah.
Because it has to be really precise. Because it's an idea, and they're drunk too.
Yeah. Yes.
They're drunk and filled with rage.
Yep.
And well, not at the moment. They're just drunk. And so it's really, Will and Kate worked really hard on
that. Well, he's got to get to a place where he. I'm getting chills just thinking about it.
Because chills too.
He says at one point, I don't know why I can't stop. I don't know why I can't stop.
And you look at his face.
Yes. You see that he doesn't know why he can't stop.
I can't. I can't.
But part of the reason he can't stop is because his mother is telling him not to stop. And you're his mother. And so I'm just wondering, like, how do you do that 8 times a week? How is it?
You pretend you're not gonna.
Like, how do you save yourself so that you can do that at the last minute of this play?
You can't save your. This play is like a full tilt boogie. I mean, it's like when you talk about leaning in, and most drama is, but you cannot lean back on your heels for a second. And what fuels that and what helps is because the enormity of the situation and the desperation is very there and immediate, and you have to do something about it. If you think about it, once this stuff starts unfolding, it's like, coming up with answers. Somebody help me. Somebody help me. You're not like just like sitting back.
And it all happens in 2 minutes.
Yeah. And I think Tracy in that scene, this is the way I'm sort of doing it is, but I know people don't see it. They just think that I'm just like, do it. But it's not really. It's just like she's filled with, they're both equally upset about it.
Yeah.
And she's like, yeah, I mean, look at that. I don't think she knows
exactly how badly it's going to go.
No.
Yeah.
No. And then the situation I think right before it's about to happen, she makes that comment about he's heading out to cash your check. I don't know. Maybe Kate would have liked me to play it a different way. But, I mean, I've kind of already said that little speech about, this is what happens to us. Everybody's going to screw us over. And that's really heartfelt. It's like, this is what's happening, And then when she says that comment, it's sort of throwaway. And that's just
the thing that pushes him over the edge.
And so Tracy's with him when the situation happens. And then at that very end, I think she's like, it's like sober time. Like that is not.
Yeah.
That's not a fisticuffs situation. That is, an unfair fight.
How does she feel about her son? Just in general, like. Let's
I think
say-
she loves her. This is an interesting thing. I think she loves different. I think everybody in this play, this community of people love each other in a different way than maybe other people love each other.
Yeah.
They're fiercely loyal. Mm-hmm. But I think she loves her son very much. If you think about it, what you get little hints of is that her husband, who I think she loved very much, died very early. And we're thinking probably when her son was about 5. Mm-hmm. So she, so God knows what she, like, kind of what role she made him play.
Right.
You know what I mean? Mothers and sons and mothers and daughters, it's like, he had, he has that thing. It's like what somebody asked him, what does your mom think about you buying this motorcycle? Because, she's got nothing to do with it. When I turned 21, she changed the locks on the doors.
Right, exactly.
And didn't give me, her job was done. Didn't give me the key. But I think she does love him very much. She's just said, it's tough. I mean, I think it's a, I think Tracy was very much in love with her husband. I think she still wears her wedding ring. She's, she probably fooled around with other people, who, Stan.
Right.
He's
a fox, by the way.
I know.
Everyone needs
totally
to cut him some slack. I'm like, why is everybody not sleeping with the bartender? He's so hot.
Oh, they are in love. Everyone's in love with him.
Yeah, okay, good.
Seriously.
Yeah.
He's kind of a hero.
Yeah.
And every guy in this play is gorgeous.
I mean, it's...
Drop dead.
It is really ridiculous.
I know, really.
Everyone settle down. Ugly actors need to work, too.
I know.
It's so awful because you see him. He's such a sweet, good boy. And then all of a sudden he's got like swastika tattoos because he's been in jail. And he's like all of a sudden like a racist and a white. Like whatever.
But
he
we
has
also
talk
deeply about that, about what happened. I mean, they did their research.
Yeah, of course.
And, also what Lynn has talked about too, generationally about the racism and how had it come up with Tracy and Cynthia before, and maybe it had, but Cynthia was just like, don't talk that way, whatever. But I think of the younger generation, they grew up as babies together,
right.
You know what I mean? Like, and it's a different generation, so that probably didn't come up
just
much.
Just so
with
the
them.
Listeners understand, Tracy and Cynthia are best friends. Tracy's white, Cynthia's black. Tracy has a white son, Cynthia has a black son, and their
Tracy's
sons are
son
best
is,
friends.
Tracy's son is Jason, right. And Cynthia's son is Chris.
Yeah.
And so... But the survival of a young white man. I'm not at all justifying any of this.
Of course, but yeah, yeah.
These people in this play know a lot of people in jail and know people that have been in jail, and they did their research really thoroughly, and how that can happen.
Yeah.
For that's survival.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about one of the things that Lynn in her research was talking about was like the bar as like a town hall, and the bar there is like the main set of your play is the bar. And I'm wondering, as Johanna, like when you're in that bar, do you how in it are you? Like, 'cause it's such a realistic set, and to the audience, it feels very much like you guys are partying at a bar. You know,
yeah, it feels good up there. I mean, you can't forget that there's 700 people looking at you, right. But it's easier. It's easier to forget. And the set is just perfect,
really,
and we're really at home on it right now. We really feel good about it, and I don't know if you know about this, but we did like 11 shows in a row at the Public at the very end, and we stopped. It's December 18th. It was a night show, and some of us got in a van and drove to Reading, Pennsylvania, because we performed for them the very next night.
No.
And then everyone else left ridiculously early in the morning, and we rehearsed on this giant stage with like bare bones, like cups and little black boxes for the bar. And I'm trying to remember. And first of all, it was one of the most magnificent performances and experiences we ever had, because we were a little nervous, you know, like.
Yeah.
Especially Will and I, we're going to get offended here, but they loved me because they know that person.
Of course.
You know what I mean? And also she's fighting fiercely for her.
Yeah.
You know.
I've never met anybody like her, and I feel like I know that person.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that they treated us, I mean, we were so tired.
Yeah.
We were so tired, but right away, we had a wonderful talk back, and then right away we went to a place that's called Mike's Bar that the bar is
based on. Wow.
And the town was there, and it's small, and they put Jimmy Colby, who plays Dan, behind the bar to drinks all night. We were like hammered. And then I was like, come on, let's go back to the hotel. And then they're like, well, no, this other really great place has made food for us at their bar. And they just had a spread of food at like midnight. It was it was beautiful. And a lot of Reading people are coming to the show. And this one girl came to the show. Then Michelle found her downstairs. She was just crying. She's here in the city. I think she's going to the American Academy of Music.
Uh-huh.
And she's from Reading. And her parents were teachers, and she came up to the dressing room and was just crying. And she said, you know, when that line comes, like, have you been up to Reading High lately? You know, they got 30-year-old freshmen. She goes, I didn't laugh because it's true.
Yeah.
And then she went, you know, we're just not like a place on a Monopoly board anymore or the brunt of people's jokes. Now we're a play.
Oh, wow. You're amazing.
You're amazing.
Thank you for coming and doing this.
This was fun. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And come back again, because
I will come back anytime you want me to.
We have to do it when you have, like, when you're not doing a play or something, because producer Mike, our producer, is literally proof, like, was his, like, he's devastated that he couldn't be here to meet you. So come back and talk to us about proof.
Yeah.
All right. Bye.
All right, bye. Nice to meet you.
You too. Bye. Theater People Podcast is a product of Theater Podcast Productions and is produced by Mike Jensen and me, Patrick Hines. To see all of the podcasts we make, including our newest podcast, True Crime Obsessed, check us out at theaterpodcastproductions.com. Special thanks to our Patreon associate producers, Robbie Rosell, Ty Williams, and Cynthia Wallach. Also to our Patreon supporters, Liz Alper, Catherine Hicks, and Danny Hicks. Thanks, you guys. If you'd like to become a patron, follow the link on our website or search Theater People Podcast at patreon.com. Thanks also to Steve Tipton, Keith Allen Herzog, Eric Emsch, Ellen Marsh, our two fabulous brand new interns, Grace Fromm and Max Sadaka, and the staff at Oswald's. We'll be back next week with Great Comet's Britton Ashford. Until then, tell your friends about us. Let's get the theater community talking.